You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1994 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother Ian Finley on the subject, Put on Beautiful Garments, O Jerusalem.
All right, in 1917, the Ottoman control of Jerusalem came to an end. When Jerusalem fell to General Allenby and the British and Allied forces. And interestingly, this was also on December the 9th, 1917. I made a little list on a slip of paper here of all the things that seem to have occurred on December the 9th. I don't know what we want to make of all this, but the first temple was destroyed by Babylon in 587 B.C. The second temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 A.D. The Bar Kokhba revolt came to an end, and the Jewish dispersion throughout the entire world began in 135 A.D. on December the 9th. And as we just mentioned, on December the 9th, Allenby entered triumphantly over Jerusalem in the defeat of the Ottoman Turk. On December the 9th, 1988, in the Gaza Strip, the Intifada began. The uprising, the Arab uprising. So one wonders what the next great and momentous event is going to happen on December the 9th. November the 2nd, 1917, just a few weeks prior to General Allenby entering Jerusalem, the Balfour Declaration came into effect. This is very renowned amongst Christadelphians. My dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation, signed by Lord Balfour. So with the implementation of this famous document, many things began to fall in place for the fulfillment of God's great plan and purpose with this earth and mankind upon it. Now, a few years ago, I was fortunate in finding a National Geographic magazine with some very fascinating maps. Fascinating to me, and I hope they will be to you. But first, let's turn to Revelation chapter 16. Revelation 16, and we realize that the words we're about to read took place under the pouring out of the sixth vial. And verse 12 reads, "The sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." And we, of course, as Bible students, are indebted to Brother Thomas for bringing to our attention the fact that the river Euphrates, which emanates from the Turkish mountains, was symbolic of the Ottoman Empire. And this Ottoman Empire, we see, I'll show you this National Geographic. I forget the year of the issue, but I know many of you keep these issues. But there is the frontispiece for this two centuries of conflict in the Middle East. And here is the Ottoman Empire at its zenith. Is that fairly seeable back there? Good. I'll see if I can read it. Occupying a strategic position at the junction of three continents, the Ottoman Empire under Suleiman became a major world power. He created a powerful navy, something that I never realized, that secured coastlines along the Persian Gulf, Red Sea, and the Eastern Mediterranean, and brought most of the North African coast under Ottoman control. I'm going to pull this down so I can read it. The broad sweep of the Ottoman Empire at the time of Suleiman's death in 1566, shown in gold, included peoples of many religious and ethnic backgrounds, taxed and administered by a central bureaucracy at the empire's periphery were numerous vassal states granted. Boy, this is tough. I'm going to take it away just for a moment, if you don't mind, to read it. At the empire's periphery were numerous vassal states granted varying degrees of control over their internal affairs in return for tribute paid to the Sultan. This wealth enabled Suleiman to amass expensive heavy artillery and to support a dependable infantry equipped with firearms. This is way back in that century, giving the Ottomans a military advantage over their disunited foes. And if you'll study this map, you'll see here that the Ottoman had a penchant for taking the coastal areas, not necessarily going into the interior. And I mention this because the prophecy buffs in our midst might want to take another look at Daniel 11, the last few chapters, and see how this answers almost perfectly to the description, where the lands of Edom, Moab, and Ammon escaped, and Ethiopia and Libya were at his steps. You see, the Ottoman occupied Egypt all up the coast. They didn't touch Edom, Moab, and Ammon, and they stretched right over here virtually to India, right to Spain. And this existed for a period of 400 years. This is no small potatoes, as you can appreciate. Now, the Ottomans lose grip on an empire. Along about 1800, the British and the French started to nibble away at the great power of this Ottoman Empire, which was rapidly becoming known as the sick man of Europe. British and Russian ambitions collide. And now what I want to point out, and I think this is rather dramatic, is as this British and Russian rivalry existed in this area, the Ottoman Empire started to shrink. And as the Ottoman Empire started to shrink, look what emerged. We've got Kuwait formed in 1899, a brand new nation in the East. Bahrain in 1880. The Trucial States in 1892. Oman, 1891. Aden, 1839. Cyprus, 1878. And we've got Egypt here, 1882, which had always existed, but now was breaking away from the Ottoman Empire. And this one's captioned, "After the War, Slicing Up the Region." This is 1920. This is after the Allenby had entered the area and the British were successful in driving the Turk out. And as we can see, we're starting to we're forming other nations. We see Yemen independent in 1918. We have the emergence in the embryonic form, we'll say, of Iraq, which we now know as a great threat in the area, Syria and Lebanon. And progressing another step, in 1948, we look here and we see that Syria was formed in 1946. Iraq formally constituted a nation in 1992. Lebanon in 1943, Israel in 1948, Transjordan in 1946, and whatever. So if you total up all the nations that sprang up around about Israel after the drying up of the River Euphrates, it's most remarkable. And it certainly fills, in a very broad sense, these kings of the East emerging as the empire shrunk. It spawned these nations, which are now the nations round about, most of which are fabulously rich from oil wealth, most of which are armed to the teeth with the most sophisticated weaponry man has ever devised. And what many of us don't stop to think about, most of us know, is that a lot of the wealth that is in this area is invested in your backyard, in the form of banks and manufacturing operations. They have a multi-billion dollar stranglehold on North American economy, and no doubt Britain and Europe as well. We have no idea of the extent of their wealth and power, which is a completely different scene than was envisaged by our pioneer brethren, and understandably so. Sir Herbert, later Viscount Samuel, excuse me, I get awfully dry up here. Sir Herbert Samuel, a Jew, became Britain's first High Commissioner of the mandated area, and hopes were very high. Dr. Heim Weizmann, who incidentally, read a number of stories of why he was favored so by the British, but the best I've heard is that he developed a process for the cheap, inexpensive manufacture of acetone, which is used in the manufacture of explosives, which was very vital to Britain in the Second World War. And as a result, he was favored with this Balfour Declaration out of gratitude for his contribution. So Dr. Heim Weizmann came out to help implement the Balfour Declaration, and he later became the first president of the State of Israel. And I'm quoting now from Kollek's book. Little conflict between Jew and Arab was envisaged at the outset. After all, as a result of the Allied victory, and with minimal effort on the Arabs' part, the Arabs of the Middle East were eventually to receive independence in territories covering more than 1 million square miles. The Arabs were going to get more than 1 million square miles. Palestine was only a few thousand square miles. So they didn't anticipate any antagonism whatsoever at the outset. Dr. Weizmann met with Emir Faisal of Transjordan, who later became the king of Iraq, who said, and they're quoting Faisal now, "The Arabs, especially the educated among us, look with deepest sympathy on the Zionist movement of the future. Arab independence and Jewish development in Palestine, I think that neither can be a real success without the other." So it got off to a good start. Things were looking good. But very rapidly, events went the other way. The Arab hostility began. And the British, to their discredit, but no doubt under the hand of the Lord, sided with the vastly more numerous Arab peoples, and then tried to create an appearance of balance between Jew and Arab. The Jerusalem expanded during this period. For the Jews, it was mostly outside the old city. But the Jews in the old city were hemmed into that little corner called the Jewish Quarter. At that time, there were 58 synagogues, which we'll talk about later, that were completely destroyed by the Muslims. In 1929, the shofar, that is the ram's horn, was blown at the Western Wall to mark the end of the fast on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, touching off a violent Arab demonstration spreading from Jerusalem down to Hebron and north to Safed. So typically, what did the British do? The British banned the shofar horn. While leaving untouched, the Muslims call to prayer five times a day from the minarets across the land and at all the feasts, for example, the Feast of Ramadan. This inequity led to a strengthening of the Haganah, the underground, the Jewish underground, that defense force, which would prove vital later in 1947 when the Arab-Jewish disturbance started. Now, just to emphasize the continual Jewish presence, because this is going to be questioned too in the upcoming period when this gets to the international court. Here is the picture that in 1868 there were 9,000 Jews and only 5,000 Muslims and 4,000 Christians. I have that in quote marks for two reasons. These were nominal Christians and Arab Christians. So they're bundled together. But you can see that the Jews outnumbered any single group at that time. And then we progress 1912, 45,000, 1922, and so on, down to 1966. Today, I've updated it as of April the 14th. There are 400,000 Jews in Jerusalem, 136,000 Muslims, 20,000 Christians, for a total population of 556,000. So Jerusalem now has over a half million people. But the emphasis on the fact that there's always been a Jewish presence in the city of Jerusalem. This is one of Martin Gilbert's charts showing the growth of Jerusalem from 1845 to 1976. And it just shows the little black areas, how they're expanding from 1845 and more in 1910, 1949 to 1976. And from 1917 to 1948 was the period known as the period of the Mandate, the British Mandate to rule over and administer Jerusalem and Palestine. Jews and Arabs of Jerusalem by 1945. The dark areas are the principal Jewish areas. And you can see that they were up here, certainly in the eastern part, Mount Scopus. And here's the old city. This is known as the Jewish quarter. Jerusalem is divided into the four quarters, the Muslim, the Armenian, the Christian, and the Jewish. And here we are in Talpiot and so on. These are Jewish enclaves all through. And this is in 1945. And the Jewish population in the area was 97,000, which composed 61.7% of the total population. 1939 to 1945. As we know, in Europe there was World War II going on, and when it ended, it brought an uneasy truce between Arab and the Jew in Jerusalem. But immediately after, for 3 years, 45, 46, 47, Palestine, and Jerusalem in particular, was a land of violence. In 1947, the British government informed the United Nations that it would terminate the mandate. It said in May 1948 that it could no longer govern. I'm one of these crazy Canadians who go ice skating in their noon hours. And one of the gentlemen that I skate with, he's an Olympic figure skating judge. And he served with the British during this period. And he was saying it was an impossible situation. He said they were trying to suppress the Jew while they were pretending to be arbitrators between the Arabs and the Jew. And he said they were brutal to the Jews. They threw them in prison, and they would hang some of them to demonstrate that they wouldn't tolerate interference and so on. And then the Haganah would capture some British officers, and they would shoot them or hang them or whatever. And this was going back and forth. And he says it was absolutely impossible. Until finally, the British just threw up their hands and says, "Let's get out of here." So this is what happened in May of 1947. May 9th, 1948, I guess it was. November the 29th, 1947, the United Nations, with a two-thirds majority, passed the partition resolution for two separate states in Palestine with international status for Jerusalem. And the next day, the Arabs launched a countrywide attack on the Jews. Now, the Arabs, of course, had the advantages. Number one, they could draw equipment from the neighboring Arab states, and they had a territorial advantage in that strategically they were on the hills and they could attack from almost any direction. So now we have Jerusalem at war in 1948. It says up in here, the last 2 weeks of British rule. I'll just read some of these items in the boxes. May the 14th, midnight, the last British troops leave Jerusalem. On the 16th of May, the Jews are on Mount Scopus are cut off. That's this area up here where the original Hadassah Hospital was located. And there's books on the horrible massacre of some Jewish doctors and nurses who were heading up here, who were going to treat both Arab and Jew in the hospital, and they were ambushed and massacred, and they were all killed on their way to Mount Scopus. On the 22nd of May, the 2,000 Jewish civilians and 100 soldiers in the Old City, besieged since February by 30,000 Syrian, Iraqi, Arab Legion, and local Arab forces, appealed in vain to the United Nations. Isn't that interesting? When the Jews are in trouble and they holler for help, nobody responds. When the Arabs holler, or whoever, they all rally to their aid. That sounds a little bit political, but I guess I'm biased. May the 28th, the Jewish quarter of the Old City surrenders. That's this sector here. They surrendered and gave up. And a quote here from Harry Levin in the book called Jerusalem Embattled. It's hard to think of the Old City without a single Jew. When last was there such a time? Nearly 800 years ago, Maimonides found Jews there. The old underground synagogue of Yohanan ben Zakkai is reputed to have been standing nearly 2,000 years ago. Now, like the neighboring Hurva, it is a shambles. Jews were in the Old City when the Seljuks conquered it, and in the days of the Crusades, when the Turks took it over. Allenby found them when he conquered it from the Turks. But today, and this is May the 28th, 1948, but today, not one is left. All right, despite Jerusalem's plight, on May the 14th, this is before the end came, 1948, as the British departed, David Ben-Gurion and his cabinet declared Israel a state officially after nearly 2,000 years. And many, of course, remember that headline or a variation of it in their local newspapers, the State of Israel is born. And this was a very, very emotional time for Christadelphians worldwide. And when we look back, it still is. So immediately that the cabinet declared Israel as a state, immediately we find that six Arab armies from Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia launched an all-out attack on the fledgling state. And in some of these comments in the boxes here, it says on April 3rd, 1949, an armistice agreement was signed by Israel and Transjordan. Under this agreement, Jerusalem was divided from north to south. As a result of 10 months fighting, many Jews and Arabs had fled, and others had been driven from their homes, with the result that the armistice lines now acted as a frontier between the two previously intermingled communities. And these were the communities that were abandoned on the east side of this point. I should mention that this was a very difficult period for the Jews. They were up against the Arab Legion, a professional army trained by Glubb Pasha, that perhaps many of you have read about from Britain, a military expert. And they had heavy equipment that was already in place at Jerusalem and commanded by trained British officers. And they immediately swung into action when this started. The Jews were in such dire straits that they used women and children to dig trenches and fill sandbags and run back and forth as messengers. This is an extension of this. These are Martin Gilbert's maps, by the way, if you ever see them in the library. Those who are keen on prophecy. On March the 17th, 1950, a Jordanian civil administration was set up in East Jerusalem. And on the 24th of April, 1950, the Jordanian parliament in Amman ratified the annexation of East Jerusalem with Amman as the capital of the enlarged state. And here we have the dividing line of the divided city. Jerusalem was divided. Jerusalem was cut in half. There is the eastern portion. This is the western portion. Jordan took over the eastern part. Jerusalem became the divided city. There's a clipping here from Time magazine where Teddy is writing a letter to the editor under the caption, "Divided Cities. We in Jerusalem rejoice with the people of Berlin as they watch the wall come tumbling down. But we, perhaps, have more reason than others. You describe Berlin as the only city in the 20th century that had a wall rammed through its innards. Unfortunately, another shared that distinction, Jerusalem, which from 1948 to 1967 had walls, barbed wire, and minefields in its midst." So unquestionably, from this period of time, Jerusalem was a divided city. And for the next 20 years, the two halves of the city led independent lives, with the watchful sandbag positions of the opposing forces facing each other across the narrow demarcation line. I'd like to read an excerpt from Brother Harold Lafferty's prophecy letter. And again, this is without dogmatism, but it is emphasizing one brother's view of what occurred at this particular point in time, 48 to 67. "As in the writings of so many other prophets, Zechariah foretells the adverse events that shall take place, then moves forward to reassure his readers about the kingdom age. He has done this in chapter 12. But then in chapter 14, in order to bring us to that sublime condition pictured in chapter 14 and 20, when even the bells of the horses shall be inscribed, holiness to the Lord, he drops back again to earlier days of the period, 1948, the establishment of Israel, until the present time, to the early days of phase one of the latter-day conflicts." Excuse me again. "To the time when in verse 2, he shall gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people, those in the western sector, outside the old walled portion, that residue shall not be cut off from the city." He's got "not" in capitals. "When does this occur? And at what time can we expect Jerusalem to be overrun? Many solutions to this problem have been advanced during the past 15 decades. We feel strongly that this passage has already been fulfilled. On May the 14th, 1948, the UNO had voted to establish a Jewish state and an Arabic state side by side in Palestine proper. The Arabs refused that arrangement at the time. Instead of accepting the state that they so vehemently demand today, they attacked Israel from every side. When they declared independence, the Jews owned and controlled the Jewish quarter, the southwestern sector of the walled city, and certain other portions of the city, such as Mount Scopus, Talpiot, etc., etc. They were unable to retain the fragile control they initially exercised and lost the old city enclaves, being driven outside the southern and western walls of the city by the Arab Legion of Transjordan. Thus, we believe Zechariah 14:2 was fulfilled. It could not have been fulfilled any earlier than this because Israel did not have control of any portion of the city. Indeed, Israel did not yet exist. So I read that for you for your consideration. Again, we look at our timeline here. And at 8 a.m. on June the 5th, 1967, a time and a day I will never forget, and I'm sure many of my age group will never, sirens wailed. 3 weeks before this, remember that hymn we sang, Jerusalem, Jerusalem? 3 weeks before this date, Israel had celebrated the anniversary of its independence with this haunting new song, Jerusalem the Golden. But the front pages of May the 15th carried news of a sudden Egyptian troop concentration in the Sinai. In the days following, in Israel, partial mobilization occurred. There was sandbag filling, and the civil defense made their preparations. And then it was learned that Egypt had massed 1 million troops and 950 tanks in the Sinai. By 8 a.m. June the 5th, war had already begun, and Israel attacked Egypt. They told King Hussein of Jordan to stay out and he wouldn't be hurt. And his reply, a mortar attack on New Jerusalem. Jerusalem and the Six-Day War, June 1967. Israel held back, but soon Jordan opened up all along the frontier, including ground attacks involving the famed Arab Legion, which attacked and captured a government house. And here we have the cross-hatching indicates the Jordanian fortified positions. And then the arrows, the black lines in the arrows, shows the Israeli forces in their counterattacks. An Iraqi division crossed into Jordan and stood ready to enter the West Bank. The Israelis fought for Old Jerusalem by encircling it to the north, which is, where's the Old City? They came around here, the north of the Old City, and encircled it. You can see the pincer movement here, fighting almost hand to hand. Old Jerusalem's walls were formidable. The brigadier commander and his forces captured a Jordanian post on the Mount of Olives, right about here. This is where they got to. And I quote him now. He says there, or at least I quote a writer. He says, there before him lay the two halves of Jerusalem, in his eyes already joined. Into his radio, he shouted to all battalion commanders, the temple, the western wall, the old city. For 2,000 years, our people have prayed for this moment. Let us go forward to victory. So just to make it a little more graphic, he was positioned on the Mount of Olives and he looked across here and his troops raced down here and along this road that we saw on our slides the other night and up the Lion's Gate Road and into this famed Lion's Gate, which I mentioned was shown in Life magazine. And at that time, of course, it had dead soldiers and by the time the battle was over, burnt out tanks and dead troops. And here you see Israeli troops entering the lion's gate. You see the lion's rampant on the side. And just to show you a little more graphically what they did, because this was a great moment in the history of Israel. They came through the lion's gate and not knowing what to expect because they were meeting heavy fire from the Jordanian legion. And they swung to the left here and came up on the Temple Mount. And then we have this famous picture that I think was in most newspapers around the world. A very dramatic scene of these men at the Western Wall, the last vestige of Herod's temple. And this was the moment of triumph, of victory. White flags were told 9:50 a.m. Wednesday, June the 7th, 1967. White flags went up everywhere. The tough paratroopers who had fought for 32 hours nonstop rushed to the wall to pray and weep like babies. And Moshe Dayan said to all the world, he said, "We earnestly stretch out our hand to our Arab brethren in peace. But we have returned to Jerusalem, never to part from her again." The city of Jerusalem was again united in its entirety. On June the 14th, 1 week later, at the Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, 250,000 Jews from all parts of the country came to Jerusalem, the largest pilgrimage to the relic of the Second Temple since the Great Dispersion 19 centuries before. And here we see a Martin Gilbert map about Jerusalem since 1967. On June the 27th, 1967, Israel's Knesset, Israel's parliament, passed three laws officially reuniting the two halves of Jerusalem. And I have a quote here from Teddy Kollek. He says, "For the two decades between 1948 and 67, Jerusalem stood at the edge of the country, its progress and expansion restricted by an artificially imposed border. With the reunification of the city after the Six-Day War, and its restoration to its rightful place at the center of the country, a new future opened before Jerusalem. Since 1967, progress in the city has been rapid. The walls and barbed wire have disappeared, houses have been built, the holy place is open to all, and equal municipal services extended to the residents of East Jerusalem." July 1980, the Jerusalem Law called, or at least it was called the Jerusalem Law, and it's still in effect, united Jerusalem would be the eternal capital of Israel. And from that moment, from that precise moment, Israel's troubles with the world in general and the Arabs in particular began. On the counter side of that, in Psalm 102, we read, "When the Lord shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory." So it was an affirmation to us that God's plan is on schedule, and to look up and lift up your heads, your redemption draweth nigh. George Adam Smith said, "The city of peace," about Jerusalem, "but in its long and stormy history, it has been repeatedly destroyed and rebuilt. It has been the bride of kings and mother of prophets. Since the grandeur days of Solomon's temple, it has seen the Babylonian captivity, suppression under the Greeks, under the Romans. It has seen the Bar Kokhba revolts when finally they were dispersed throughout the world in 135. It has endured the Constantine and Byzantine periods, capture and overthrow by the Persians, by the Crusaders, by the Muslims, by the Ottomans, and the British. On June the 7th, 1967, and let's look at the chapter in Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21 and at verse 24. "And they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And if you'll look in the prophet Jeremiah chapter 25 at verse 29, we read, "For lo, I begin to bring evil on the city which is called by my name. And should ye be utterly unpunished, you other nations? Ye shall not be unpunished. For I will call for a sword upon all the inhabitants of the earth, saith the Lord of hosts." And if you'll turn back to Isaiah chapter 51 and at verse 17, we read, "Awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem, which hast," past tense in this prophecy, "which hast drunk at the hand of the Lord the cup of his fury. Thou hast drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out." In verse 22, "Thus saith the Lord, the Lord and thy God that pleadeth the cause of his people, behold, I have taken out of thine hand this cup of trembling," this symbolic cup of God's judgmental fury. He's taken it out of the hand, the cup of trembling, "even the dregs of the cup of my fury. Thou shalt no more drink it again." But what do we see in the next verse? "But I will put it into the hand of them that afflict thee, which have said to thy soul, Bow down, that we may go over. And thou hast laid thy body as the ground and as a street to them that went over." That takes us to Zechariah chapter 12. That was Jeremiah 25, and the last reference was Isaiah 51. And now we're looking at Zechariah chapter 12, verse 1. "The burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens and layeth the foundation of the earth and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem." All the people round about. Do what I did. Get your concordances out and look up round about. And you will find it means compass, on every side, surrounding, contiguous, encircling. Now go with me, if you will, to Numbers 33. And our brother Noel used this reference also in another very interesting connection. Numbers 33 at verse 55. And we all know the scenario. The children of Israel have come out of the captivity in Egypt. They've come through the Red Sea, through the hand, miraculous hand of the Lord, and they're about to enter the land. And in verse 55 of Numbers 33, he says, "But if ye will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which ye let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein ye dwell." Joshua lends confirmation to this point in the 23rd chapter, Joshua 23, verse 13. And I believe these are Joshua's dying words, or getting close to his death. "Know for a certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until ye perish from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you." When is this curse lifted? When those contiguous, those encircling, those round about will be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your side. When is this lifted? We turn to Ezekiel chapter 28 and at verse 24 we read, Ezekiel 28 verse 24, "And there shall be no more a pricking briar unto the house of Israel, nor any grieving thorn of all that are round about them, that despise them, and they shall know that I am the Lord. What conditions will prevail for Jerusalem and for Israel then? Look at verse 26. And they shall dwell safely therein, and shall build houses and plant vineyards. Yea, they shall dwell with confidence when I have executed judgments upon all those that despise them round about them, and they shall know that I am the Lord their God. The kings of the east that we referred to at the outset of this lesson have reemerged and are more sophisticated with more tools of destruction and more strategic geography than ever before. There is a new threat, a new mix that Israel is very aware of. The Scud attack made them realize that they are vulnerable to missiles. They had their air force in the air, but they could do nothing. This has changed the equation. Israel, I can tell you, is extremely concerned about the future.